When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
You're listening to the Co-Main Event Podcast. And now your hosts, Ben Folks and Chad Dundas.
That's right. You're listening to another episode of the Co-Main Event Mixed Martial Arts Podcast. I'm Chad Dundas. That's Ben Folks. We're both longtime MMA journalists, and for the last 9 years, we've been meeting here every single week to break down the action in the wild, weird, and occasionally wonderful world of mixed martial arts. Ben, we had fights in the morning over the weekend, and UFC 267 served up a lot of action. You got a new champion at light heavyweight, a new slash old interim champion at men's bantamweight, couple of prospects starting to solidify themselves as potential title contenders. And then you turn around and, oh, by the way, the UFC packs up the octagon from Abu Dhabi and heads to Madison Square Garden out there in New York City for UFC 268 this Saturday. Suffice to say, we got a lot to talk about. But first, perhaps the most important breaking news of the week. The CME is on Instagram, my man. Why don't you tell the people all about it?
See, there's this application, a web application. You can get it on your phone, Chad. It's called Instagram, sometimes also referred to as IG or the Gram.
Okay.
You following along so far?
Is this brand new? Did this just come out, this web application?
Newish, let's say.
Okay. Yeah.
The CME has created a page, perhaps not soon enough, because when we went to create the Co-Main Event Instagram page, we found some people have beat us to some combinations of Co-Main Event. And so it was either get a little more creative with the name or use a bunch of annoying like underscore space kind of things. I personally hate that. So you can find us over there on the gram at CME if you nasty, all one word. The old school, the heads who've been riding with us for a long time, well, remember that when this podcast first came out, we made it very clear that they could refer to it as the Co-Main Event or the CME if you nasty.
Yeah.
So there's no better way to declare just how nasty you in fact are than to hit that follow button on our Instagram page. You know, we have a good time over there. We keep it light. Nothing too heavy. We're still, and also I would urge people to understand, still a little bit of a work in progress, but hey, if you have hilarious MMA memes and whatnot that you come across, send them on over to us. And, you know, we had ourselves a good time hanging out for UFC 267.
Yeah. Well, I can't wait to check it out. I can't wait to check out Instagram.
Yeah.
I'm excited now that I know about it.
You're going to want to go to the app store.
Okay.
That's the first move.
Where's that? Is that downtown somewhere?
It's right over there by the Kinko's.
Okay, great.
Yeah, the one thing I know, I've heard you every once in a while when you're talking about fighters' activity on Instagram, and you will refer to it as Instagram.com, which I'm telling you right there, you have outed yourself once you do that. It's not really meant to be a web, like a desktop computer-based interaction, and they make it very clear when you go to that website that this isn't really how you're supposed to be doing it.
Is it more of a blog site?
Sure. Sure, Chad. It's more of a blog site.
Is it a sort of a MySpace kind of a thing?
Think of it as a MySpace.
Okay.
And
kind
really
of a cross between MySpace and Friendster.
You're going to want to put together a list for me of your top six friends or whatever, and really make sure that you're prepared for the fallout that comes with that when certain people get, you know, inevitably slighted.
Well, you know, I can't wait. I can't wait to find it. CME if you nasty. Is that what it is? Is that where they can find us over on Instagram?
That's where it is. Instagram.com.
Amazing. We got music this week from our guy, CMEO, a.k.a. Co-Main Event Podcast listener, Alfred Larson. Been with us for a long time. If you like what you hear from him on the show, you can check out more over at soundcloud.com/CMEO. That's S-E-E-M-I-O in CMEO. Per usual, three rounds this week in the Co-Main Event Podcast. In round number one, Glover Teixeira overcomes the legendary Polish power and the suicide rope to become, simply put, the greatest human being who has ever lived. And in round number two, can any men's bantamweight survive the Peter Yawn zombie apocalypse? And in round number three, for two times in 2 weeks, the UFC puts on a numbered event where the poster says two title fights. This weekend at UFC 268, it's Usman versus Covington 2 and Nama Yunus versus Zhang 2. Too sweet? Too much? Should this have been round 2? To be continued. All that plus are you fucking kidding me and just saying stuff. But first, like we always do about this time, let's do a little bit of listener mail.
Listener mail.
Now, this first piece of listener mail comes to us from John over on Patreon.
Okay.
By the way, if you like the Co-Main Event Podcast, you like what you're hearing right now, you feel like you want more of it, we invite you cordially to join the team over at patreon.com/co-main-event. Ben Folks and I are there all week doing podcasts pretty much every damn day at this point. We got the Wednesday live chat. We got the Thursday brand new podcast doing the damn thing. We got the Friday Power Hour. Sometimes we got weekend fight parties, hangouts. You can come chill with us. There's a message board just for the patrons over there. Come hang out. Patreon.com/co-main-event. We got a patronage tier for every budget. And this email from John refers to our recurring segment over there on the Friday Power Hour. $20 we never want to see again, which is pretty self-explanatory, Ben. You and I take $20 from the CME kitty. Every week, we put down some bets on the coming fights, if it's the UFC or it's Bellator. And the only rule is you gotta bet the $20. And yep. Then we let the chips fall where they may, and we reconnoiter the next week. We talk about how we did, and then we look ahead to the weekend's action for our upcoming bets. So bear that in mind as we dip into this email here from John, where the subject line is, I took your gambling advice, and look where it got me.
Okay. Advice is not the word I would use.
Yeah, we need to stop John right there. As Alistair Overeem might say, we got to correct him on a fact.
Right.
As we are pretty upfront about the idea that we do not want anyone else to follow our leads on these bets. This is like the opposite of gambling advice, whatever that may be, right?
Except for when it works, and then you're welcome.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Then you're an idiot if you didn't place the bets.
Yeah.
But most of the time, we're out here letting everybody know this shit is for entertainment purposes only. Do not follow our leads. We are not good at it. And, you know, follow along at your own risk, unless it works, in which case, you're all very fucking welcome.
You can thank the hybrid anti-system.
Yep, so here's John's email. He writes, so I was listening to your discourse about Chimaev having a rough time with that COVID and whether the long-term effects could be seen with him barely making weight, and I thought, these guys have made a compelling argument, and I will now add Li Jingliang to my accumulator. Then out comes Chamat Khamzat, bouncing around like he had his pre-fight espresso injected straight into his veins, and suddenly your arguments seemed a little bit less compelling. He says, 3 pounds I'll never see again. Betting advice aside, your shows are a great listen. Ah, boy, guilty as charged on this one, right? Because, let's say we're not the only ones out here, but we've been looking forward to Khamzat Chimaev's return to the octagon for a while now because During the first phase of his career, he was obviously a big favorite of the UFC. It seemed like they had a lot of promotional power behind Khamzat Chimaev, kind of setting him up as perhaps the next big thing in this weight class. And then he gets COVID and everything kind of goes haywire on him. He had a rough time with it. He was out for a long period of time. At one point, he made a feint toward retirement, said he was done. He would not return. We had to call in the Chechen dictator to give him a pep talk to say, hey, man, you're carrying the hopes and dreams of the whole nation on your back. I really strongly advise you to reconsider this retirement. Khamzat Chimaev did all that. And so we were pointing at this fight against Li Zhengliang, and we said, hey, you know what? If you show up for this thing, not 100%, not ready to go, not in the best shape, the leech will expose you, because that's the kind of dude that he is. And then, Ben, as you pointed out last week on comainevent.com, Chimaev goes out there, misses weight on the first attempt last week, and then shows back up to weigh in again and jukes the damn scale for 5 pounds.
Yeah.
By leaning on the towel, which, by the way, that's doing too much.
Yeah.
Don't take 5 pounds off the scale by leaning on the towel, Khamzat. Take 1.5 pound off. You're leaning too hard on the towel, buddy. So we had concerns. And I think both of us took Li Zhengliang at the plus money, the underdog money, headed in there into the fight against Khamzat Chimaev. And then that did not work out.
No.
Khamzat Chimaev wore Li Zhengliang around the cage like a goddamn button en route to choking him unconscious in the first round. Khamzat Chimaev is back, my friend, and it appears at this point the sentiment online is that Chimaev is the real deal, and maybe he's knocking on the door of a title opportunity. I don't know.
Okay. A couple things about this. Well, I mean, I know it's easy with the benefit of hindsight to go back and be like, this was a stupid bet that you guys put down. I mean, we acknowledged why Khamzat Chimaev went in there as a favorite, but we thought as underdog, or at least I thought as underdogs on the card go, that Li Zhengliang was going in there at pretty high underdog odds, and there was always a chance that maybe Chimaev in his first fight back after this lengthy COVID battle would not be as good as we have seen him in the past. Also, I'm just going to say it. I think it was stopped early.
Okay. Yeah, you think they should have been allowed to continue?
I think
maybe had you given Li Zhengliang the chance to wake up?
Yeah.
From the choke?
If he
and then maybe
given...
he could have afforded himself better. He might have come back to win. What you needed was Vakishlav Kisilev, or whatever that guy's name was, the referee from the Easy Dos Santos fight. You needed that guy out there in this one. Then maybe that fight would still be going even as we record this. I don't know.
I just felt like in order to really test Chimaev, the leech had to take him into the later rounds. And if the ref had given him a chance, I think maybe he still does that. But
yeah,
it's fine. Early stoppage, that's okay. It's how it goes sometimes. I will point out that my hybrid system where I bet Amanda Ribas via decision, that paid out. So it's not that our betting advice is bad. It's that you just have to know which parts to ignore and which parts to just go all fucking in on.
Yeah. Isn't
you know?
That the whole game? Isn't that the whole game of the gambling? As I sit here today on Monday and we record this show, I stand by the philosophy that led us to the Li Zhengliang bet. If you've ever been to a soccer game and the offense puts together a good-looking attempt and you get a nice cross in front of the goal and then the guy kicks it and it goes off the side of his foot and he misses the shot, people in the audience, they say, nice idea, nice idea. Even though it didn't work out, this bet on Li Zhengliang was a nice idea.
It's
a nice idea.
Chimaev really did go in there and wear him around like a button.
Yeah, it was ugly. And then Chimaev gets on the... Well, first of all, fucking carries him over across the octagon.
Yeah.
So he can speak to the UFC president while he's got this guy elevated for the takedown. And then slams him down, climbs on his back, chokes him unconscious, effortlessly, really, let's just say.
Yeah.
And then gets on the mic with Daniel Cormier in the post-fight. And you can see why Khamzat Chimaev has the makings of a potential star in mixed martial arts. A nice little in the bubble star for the UFC, especially if you're going to be going over to Abu Dhabi and highlighting the Russian fighters on a frequent basis, you can tell why Khamzat Chimaev would be a guy you'd want to have on the roster and have in a high-profile position. Carrying your opponent over to the side of the cage so you can tell Dana White not to be looking at his phone, that he needs to be watching your fight.
Don't look at phone.
That's some baller shit, man. That is some baller shit from Khamzat Chimaev.
Well, and again, it's another one of these fights where he goes in and takes literally zero damage.
Yeah.
He changes levels and shoots on the first punch that the leech threw and does not take a single blow, really, in this entire fight. I feel like that is honestly a blueprint for good career longevity in mixed martial arts. I don't know why people haven't thought of this before. Just go in there and win without even getting hit.
Yeah.
It's a pretty good idea. But it is, I mean, we talked about this as being like an interesting test for him, especially coming back off the COVID, and he absolutely blows the doors off Li Jingliang. So then what do you do now? Like everybody, I think it's weird because if people say, oh, get this man a title shot soon, then people will be like, oh, that's a little bit too much. I don't know if you beat Li Jingliang and go right into a title shot. But then when there are other sort of would-be mid-range welterweight contenders like Neil Magny, like stepping up and being like, I'll fight that guy. People are like, no way, bro, you'll get trashed. And it's like, well, what do we want? Like either the guy goes straight to the top spot or we go, okay, you pass this test. Let's set you another test. I mean, I get it because he's passing these tests so easily that we want to see him tested by somebody else who can maybe, give him a little bit of a tougher fight. But we also seem like when he absolutely destroys people like that, it's tough to even know where that puts him. Is he the best who has ever done it? We don't know yet, but people can kind of talk themselves into that. We've seen people get on that hype train before, and then as soon as a guy stumbles or loses one fight, then they'll be like, oh no, he was a flash in the pan anyway. Like, I do think you need some sort of middle stop between Li Jingliang and a title shot, but I can also see how the UFC looking around would be like, well, Kamaru Usman is already in reruns. Maybe it's not such a terrible idea.
Yeah. Khamzat Chimaev is 27 years old. Here's some numbers for you. 23-0 in his freestyle wrestling career.
Okay.
3-0 as a mixed martial arts amateur. Now 10-0 as a mixed martial arts professional. Never been to decision in his entire career. Now 4-0 in the UFC, all of them stoppages. The last two against Gerald Meerschaert and Li Jingliang, who are themselves, respectable opponents to defeat. And like you said, out here taking no damage, barely seeming to break a sweat, having conversations with Dana White while you're doing it, and then getting on the mic with Daniel Cormier, who says, I'm here with Khamzat Chimaev. And he says, of course you're here with me. We all knew you were going to be here with me the whole time. What you do next with Khamzat, I think, is interesting. He's making noise about Nate Diaz, and there has been some speculation about Nate Diaz trying to fight out his contract to hit the open market as a free agent. It would be a very, very, very UFC thing to do to try to make Nate Diaz take a fight with Khamzat Chimaev and just get obliterated in his final fight in the octagon before he becomes a free agent. If I'm Nate Diaz, obviously I don't want to have anything to do with that. But we'll see. We'll see where the chips fall here, I guess. I feel like kind of the sky's the limit, not only for Chimaev at this point, but also kind of in his next fight. Like, you could tell me he was going to do absolutely anything, I would mark it on my calendar. I would want to watch it. And as long as it seems like something like a step forward, I would be interested to see. And like, I wouldn't turn my nose up at Neil Magny or somebody like that, because that's a dude who keeps beating your prospects. If I was the UFC, I might think twice about it. But that seems like a good next test for Khamzat Chimaev. And if he walked through Neil Magny the same way he walked through Li Jingliang, maybe then you start talking about a top contender fight, man. I don't know. But the dude, he silenced my doubts.
Yeah.
I'll say that.
I mean, he seemed to think that the Nate Diaz possibility was a good idea. If I'm Nate Diaz and the UFC offers me that one, I would interpret them as saying, how soon do you really want out of this contract? Do you want out bad enough that you'll go ahead and take this fight, which might be an ass kicking for you? Or are you willing to say no and have us extend your contract by 6 months while you wait for a better offer? And I don't know. If Nate Diaz really is thinking, hey, let me get out of this contract so I can go box a Paul brother or whatever, then I would think he would probably just say, yeah, sure. Give me that guy. I'll do what I can with it. And if you're talking about a Nate Diaz versus Jake Paul boxing match or something, don't you think that even if he went in there and took a beating and took a loss against Khamzat, it wouldn't really change his value in that kind of a fight afterwards?
Yeah, people are still going to want to watch any Diaz versus any Paul in a boxing fight on pay-per-view. Yeah. I think that sets the pay-per-view world on fire right there. Next question this week comes to us from Richie Cunningham over on Patreon. You see, Ben, people can't even sign up for the Patreon under their real names.
Are you suggesting that somebody is choosing the name of Ron Howard's character from Happy Days as a nom de plume here?
That's exactly what I'm suggesting.
Okay.
He writes,
it's possible.
Is the hangman in the process of trading his noose for a lasso, using the lumber from his gallows to build a fence for his livestock? In other words, is Dan the Hangman Hooker trying to be the next action-fighting, overly active Donald the Cowboy Cerrone? And is this an advisable career path in the JSF era of MMA? I mean, I'm not quite worried about that with Dan Hooker at this point. He has fought three times in 2021, and as we talked about at length, a little bit more of a month turnaround here between his win over Nasrat Haqparast at UFC 266 and his loss on Saturday to Islam Makhachev at UFC 267. I don't think this is a Cowboy Cerrone type career ambition for Dan Hooker. I think that this one with Makhachev was just an opportunity that presented itself, and we have heard a lot about the city kickboxing guys and the trouble that they have to have, you know, getting in and out of New Zealand due to that country's actual serious COVID protocols, coming to the United States to fight. And I think Dan Hooker just thought, okay, here is a legitimate up-and-coming prospect that if I just decide to stick around in America for an extra month without having to go through the rigors of getting back home and then getting back here, I can fight him, I can make some more money, and if I win, I'm right back in the thick of it in what is a very, very competitive weight class where, frankly, being in the thick of it is impressive. It's a hard thing to do. So for Dan Hooker, maybe it was a risk that he thought was worthwhile to take. I don't necessarily expect him to become the guy who will fight absolutely anybody in this weight class at the drop of a hat. I think this was just a one-time deal for Dan Hooker, a situation that presented himself that he thought was good to take. Obviously, you go out there against Makhachev and you get kind of smashed in 2 minutes and 25 seconds. You end up getting Kimura'd in the first round at UFC 267. And maybe, as you said, hindsight, you start to think differently about this opportunity. But I think it was one for Dan Hooker that was probably worth taking this risk in this limited basis to take this short notice fight and fight Islam Makhachev.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to talk about hindsight and all that, and us trying to determine the odds of victory for some of these underdogs, we also talked about this fight in our, I believe you had it in a parlay, didn't you?
I had it in my big swing.
Yeah.
My grand slam home run swing, my all underdog parlay. And my thought was, well, at least we got it out of the way early. Because this was the first leg that I needed. Dan Hooker goes out there. It's not close. It's not competitive. There's never a moment where you really thought the fight was in doubt. And I got my parlay smashed fast. And I was like, at least I wasn't on the edge of my seat on the last fight, hoping, waiting to see if it paid out. At least it was immediately, I was like, oh no, that one's dead. That one's dead in the water.
Well, and you'll recall that when you were reading off this parlay, you got as far as mentioning Dan Hooker. And I said, well, you're fucked.
Well, you say that in all of my bets. It's
well, not, I was right this time, itself. Though, so that's why it's worth mentioning on Monday. But this one was always going to be a tough stylistic matchup for him, and especially when you don't have a full training camp to really prepare for what that guy brings. And you're going out there, you're throwing low kicks against the guy who wants to take you down, and what do you know? Sure enough, he uses one of those, gets you down, and you're not able to get back up again. And, I mean, I understand his thinking. Which, like, as you said, you're having trouble. If you go home, you don't know when the next time you're going to be able to get back out and fight again is. He had wanted this matchup before anyway. He thought, if I do win, first of all, everybody's going to give you all the tough guy attaboy points for being willing to step up and have these brass balls to even take the chance to begin with. And then if you do win, you are right back in there in the title talks. Plus, maybe the UFC makes it financially worth it for you when you're stepping up to help them out and plug a hole on the card. So I can understand all that stuff going in. But it also always felt like this was going to be a super tough fight for him. But then I can understand why it's easier for us to look at it and be like, oh, I don't see how you win this one, Dan Hooker. If he is trying to be, you know, right there in the top of the division, he has to tell himself that he can beat somebody like this, that or that at least he has a chance to figure it out and go out there and do it. Otherwise, if you tell yourself like, oh, here's one guy who I would like to avoid at all costs for the rest of my career, that could be tough psychologically for you to talk yourself into thinking that you're going to be champ someday. So I get it. I also don't think that it's necessarily a sign that he's just going to say, fuck it, I'll fight whoever on whatever kind of notice, at least not yet. But you do wonder what you take away from this one if you're Dan Hooker. Do you go home thinking, well, this was a mistake. I shouldn't have done that. I should have just like taken my lower level win, gone home, planned for the next one, and thought a little more broadly big picture? Or do you think like, hey, you know, I swung and I missed, but that's the way it goes?
Yeah, if you're Dan Hooker, I'm sure you're happy to have the extra payday, frankly. You're probably going home with a nice chunk of change in your pocket, and Christmas is coming up here in a couple months, and it's probably going to be nice to have the extra financial security for the foreseeable future, at least in the short term. If I was going to worry about anything, if I was Dan Hooker, it would be that I'm 1-3 now in my last four, and you probably need to get on the winning side of things in your next couple of bouts here after the losses to Dustin Poirier, Michael Chandler, and Islam Makhachev, which are, you know, those are respectable losses. Those are as respectable as losses get in this sport. But you do need to put some green on the Wikipedia page if you're Dan Hooker in the next couple of fights. So that would be the thing that I would be concerned about. You know, I would probably think specifically about this fight that, yeah, I took a chance. I went for this opportunity. I made this money. I'm glad I will have the extra bucks in my pocket for the next couple months. But now I need to get back to business with my actual coaches, with my actual training camp. And I need to win a couple fights because then, you know, then if you, like you said, if you're telling yourself you're going to be the champ someday, you got to turn the ship around here. You got to write the course and get back to the winning ways. So that's, if I was Dan Hooker, that's what I would be concerned about at this point. Although, just as a side note here, much like Khamzat Chimaev picking up Li Jingliang and carrying him across the octagon while talking to Dana White before you get slammed, it's got to kind of suck to get Kimura'd by Islam Makhachev while Khabib Nurmagomedov is yelling encouragements to him through the chain link. Right up in his corner, and the greatest of all time is sitting there being like, yeah, tear that arm off, or whatever he's saying in Russian. I don't have the translation, but I assume that's what it was.
That was the spirit of the comment anyway. And it's not where you want to be, is caught in a sandwich between Islam Makhachev and Khabib Nurmagomedov. No, not in any sense.
This next question comes to us from Michael Misping, who has emailed us a couple times here over the last couple weeks. He writes, what the actual fuck was going on with the officiating in the Dos Santos-St. Denis fight? The only explanation in my mind is that the ref is actually just Mario Yamasaki in disguise as an old Russian man. I have never heard the commentary team so fired up at the official during a fight. Update, I'm sending this email as it was announced that this ref was removed from his next assignment. Damn, son. Cheers, guys. So this this was one that'll stick in the old memory banks here. Our guy Easy Dos Santos went out there and got a unanimous decision win over Benoit St. Denis, a welterweight fight on the prelim card on Saturday night. But this is a fight that is going to probably be remembered for all the wrong reasons. And that is that your referee here, who's probably, I'm butchering the pronunciation of his name, but Vakislav Kisilev, let Benoit St. Denis take an absolute hellacious beating down the stretch in this fight for about the second half of the second round and then most of the third round, while the UFC broadcast team lambasted this guy on the airwaves, rightly, I think, properly. I think that they were right about this one. And if their commentary was to be believed, the rest of the referee staff, including Mark Goddard, looked on with horror. But you let this guy get beat down for about 7 minutes.
Did you see, though, that noted MMA referee Jason Herzog jumped on social media to defend him?
I didn't see that, but I kind of believe it because as I was going to say, as we talked about this, like this fight should have been stopped at some point. But it was also one of those weird deals where if you're going through your referee checklist in your mind and you're thinking about stepping in to stop it, I mean, Benoit Saint-Denis was doing all the stuff that as a fighter you're supposed to do to keep your fight from getting stopped. He was firing back. He was popping up off the ground. He was staying busy. He was responding to the referee's cues and the things that he was asking him to do. He was doing all of those things. It was just that while he was doing it, he was getting his ass handed to him by Easy Dos Santos. So like my personal opinion, you should have stopped it. If you were the ref in there in the heat of the moment and Denis appears to be game and still going at it and getting up off the mat and all the things you're asking him to do, I could also see how you would be like, I'm going to give him a little time here.
You know, if it was only that, I would think, yeah, maybe there's a case that people got on this ref too much. But there were a few different weird things about how he was reffing this fight. Because for one thing, there's always the tricky issue of when to stop it. And I'm sure you could argue that, hey, look at how Saint-Denis was still doing some stuff there in the third, wasn't absolutely getting his ass kicked anymore. So doesn't that prove that it was the right call not to stop it? And I think sometimes that gets you into some iffy logic. But it's also, you know, at one point there's like an eye poke, and he's communicating to the ref. It seems like that he can't see, and the attitude there is like, well, okay, man, do the best you can out there. Like, just usually I can't see is where the fight ends. And especially when he's like pointing at his eye and kind of shaking his head, and we don't get a doctor in there. We don't get a translator. We're not doing any of that stuff. We're just trying to get the fight restarted as quickly as possible. And then also then going to turn around and take a point away right away from Easy Dos Santos for an inadvertent groin shot. And you're just like, how are you overreacting and underreacting at all in the same fight? It's just, and especially you combine all that with everybody thinking we basically know who the refs are in this sport. You're over there in Abu Dhabi, you see this guy, and everybody's like, who the fuck is this guy? Also, it seems like he's not doing a great job, and so he gets the hook right away here. All around, not a great outing for him.
Yeah, and like Benoit Saint-Denis telling you that he couldn't see was your get-out-of-jail-free card right there if you're that ref, because you can call it right there. Just say, guy told me he couldn't see. Honestly, they shouldn't have let him come out after the second round. Like, I think that the referee and the medical staff and probably his own corner at that point should have had a responsibility to this guy to come in and say, hey, man, let's come back another day and do this again. Like, this wasn't your time. Let's do it some other time. That's when they should have called it off. But they, you know, he ended up going the distance and loses the lopsided decision here to Easy Dos Santos. As I said, in a fight that when we think of it, we will not think of it probably because of either guy's performance.
Yeah.
And that's a shame. All right, that's going to do it for listener mail this week. If you have a question, comment, or concern you want to air to the podcast in future weeks, you know how to do it. You go to our website, comainevent.com, click the link in the top right-hand corner of the screen that says email the podcast. That'll get you in touch with us. As for right now, though, we're going to go ahead and get started with round number one. Well, Ben, perhaps the only bad thing about Glover Teixeira versus Jan Blachowicz is that one of these dudes had to lose this fight. Because Teixeira and Blachowicz are both real likable guys and kind of against all odds and unexpectedly have become leading men in this light heavyweight division, which is clearly an entirely different world now without John Jones lording at the top of it as he did for years and years. But in a sport where we don't get a ton of real, true, heartwarming, feel-good stories, man, you gotta big up Glover Teixeira this week for going out there, 20 years in the game, 42 years old, his second UFC title shot, a guy who probably a long time ago we had all discounted as a person who had already shown us his best in the cage, and he gets the stoppage win to take the gold from Jan Blachowicz, the new UFC light heavyweight champion, the likable Glover Teixeira, and in a fight where, frankly, he kind of dominated from start to finish before getting the rear naked choke victory here in the second round to actually hang the banner and get the belt. We're sitting here on Monday, man. You've had a couple days to think about it. What strikes you first and foremost about this victory, about Glover Teixeira's journey, and the fact that we are sitting here on this podcast, 475 episodes into this thing, talking about champion Glover Teixeira?
You know, I know some people are going to get hung up on, are we actually talking about the best light heavyweight in the world at this point? Because that's, it's sort of inevitable. 42-year-old guy who we've seen try and fail for the UFC title before, and now he's the champion, and in the absence of John Jones, this division just feels very different. And so people, I think, understandably, are going to want to have that conversation. And if you're somebody like Scotty Coakes over there trying to make a case for, you know, your guy Vadim Nemkov as the best light heavyweight in the world, maybe stuff like this is good news. I would just like us to maybe admit that it doesn't always have to be the foremost thing on our minds. Especially, as we talked about a little bit on Friday, it has not always been the case that we could feel good about whoever was the champion at the UFC light heavyweight division. It's not always been a nice guy show over right there in recent years. And here it really was. You know, both Glover and Jan Blachowicz, just two good-natured competitors going in there, and you felt sort of good about the whole thing. Even Jan Blachowicz after he loses, you know, he takes a left hook upside the head, gets put down and choked out, and it's just kind of like, well, I left the Polish power in the hotel room. Guess he got me here. And you're like, man, just everybody is being pretty cool about this. The person being least cool about it, honestly, is John Jones on Twitter. And you knew that was going to happen too, where he's going to jump on there and want to talk a whole bunch of shit about it, and to the predictable replies, especially given his recent legal history. And yet, I think, like, here's where the fight game gives us these opportunities, if we're willing to take it, where we can just sort of sit back for a minute and just appreciate how good it must feel for somebody like Glover, and how we can feel good on his behalf, especially when he's out there talking about how, you know, I always thought about how what it would be like to win a title and what I'd feel like waking up the next day, and it's better than I thought. Like, it's really good. And you're like, man, that's just, how do you not feel happy for the guy? It's just a story of resilience and overcoming some difficult stuff to get there. And he performed really well. Like, he came out there, put Jan Blachowicz down early, was working the goddamn can opener, Chad.
Yeah, he was, you know what he was doing there? He's playing to his demographic. 42-year-old Glover Teixeira is out there trying to work the can opener, like, for us, for the old heads. He's like, hey, remember this? Remember the can opener?
Yeah.
Remember when motherfuckers used to win fights with the can opener?
Remember in the Pride video game when Igor Vovchanchian could submit you with a can opener? Like, sure, let's just go ahead and show people that maybe these old techniques still have a place in MMA. He wallops Jan Blachowicz with a really good left hook that sends him kind of spiraling a little bit there. And I'll admit that first when I saw the actual finish the first time, saw it live, I thought, that's a quick tap from Jan Blachowicz. And it made me wonder, like, if he was injured. I think they speculated about the broadcast, too. Like, does he have some kind of injury, and that's why he was ready to get out of there? And then when you see it on replay, you from a different angle, you realize, no, he was just under that chin, man. Like, he does not need a whole lot of openings or a whole lot of time to finish that choke once you give him that position. Like, I realize he doesn't look like a spectacular athlete, maybe doesn't blow you away getting off the bus, but Glover Teixeira is really fucking good. That man's about his business.
Yeah, and he's one of these guys who knows who he is, knows what his skills are, knows how to utilize them, and, like, at this point kind of excels at getting the fight to the place where he can use those skills. And that's what he did against Anthony Smith. That's what he did in this fight against Yanni Blackjacks. And now he's the UFC light heavyweight champion. And at least for today, I'm totally unconcerned with historical significance or who is the best light heavyweight in the world. I'm just feeling good for Glover Teixeira, who, like I said at the top, is one of these guys who is one of the few characters in this sport that it seems like everybody can kind of agree on, that we are all feeling good for this guy today. And that's enough for the time being, especially in today's UFC world, where sometimes it feels like we're looking around for the good stories, the stuff that we can feel good about, the stuff that reinforces how much we like this sport and how much attention we pay to it. And I think Glover Teixeira is that guy today. And I'm excited for him. And the furthest that I am willing to look ahead in the future at this point is to talk about who he should fight next, and to mention that when Chuck Liddell was knocked off the top of the light heavyweight mountain, it kind of ushered in this era where for a while it felt as though like everyone, like the Stanley Cup, got to take the belt home for a night. Right, we went through this situation where you had Rampage Jackson and Forrest Griffin, Rashad Evans, Lyoto Machida, Shogun Hua, all had very short stints with the title, and then John Jones came along and put the thing on lock for 1,500 days or whatever it was. So the only thing that I'm willing to say about the future, or the thing that I'll be a little worried about here, is if we get into a situation where you're basically playing round robin with the belt at 205, which at that point I think is maybe not great for the division, for a division that had been the UFC's marquee division for much of its history. But for today, man, I'm just happy that Glover Teixeira is the champ. I think that we should all just feel good for him.
Yeah, I mean, I get what you're saying, that sometimes it feels like that is not great, but it's also maybe just part of the cycle, right? Whenever you have a dominant champion and finally gets either knocked off or moves on to a different division, that it's suddenly wide open, and that's one of the fun things about it. And then you get to a point where maybe it's not so fun anymore, but like, I think it happens that way for a reason, and it's not necessarily the worst thing.
Yeah. Right now you got Yuri Prochazka is probably your number one contender at this point. If we don't think about a rematch of some kind, I don't know if there's been any talk of that. Alexander Rakic also on that list. And of course, Magomed Ankalaev, who also got a win recently here, is climbing up that list as well. So if you want to look at immediate potential title contenders for Glover Teixeira, those are probably your three dudes right out the gate.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're looking at Yuri P as your guy, and you know, Glover even mentioned him. Do you see the shot of Yuri in the crowd? Where usually, you know, it's one of those moments where you're like, okay, let's talk about the guy who's going to be the next contender, and he's sitting right there, front row, like just a few feet away from the cage. This one, I couldn't really tell from the camera angle, but it seemed like maybe his seats weren't quite that good. Like maybe we had to go back there a few rows to find Yuri, but he's sitting there, and just because he's just surrounded by people like in the crowd, when they cut to him, it does seem like, oh, it's just a really in shape spectator with interesting hair for a second. Yeah. And then you realize like, Oh, that's him. That's the guy we're talking about. But like, I mean, you tell me Glover Teixeira versus Yuri Prochazka for the title. Fuck yeah. That seems like a good time, man. I'll watch the shit out of that fight.
Hashtag would watch Yuri Prochazka, a delightful Weirdsmobile. So, yeah, I would love to see him fight Glover Teixeira for the title. All right, let's do Are You Fucking Kidding Me, Ben? And then we can move on to round number two. Ben, what's your Are You Fucking Kidding Me this week?
Well, Chad, you mentioned, you know, this one had a morning start time. I believe it started around 8:30 a.m. here in the One True Time Zone on Saturday. I was delighted by that. I, you know, walked the dog down, got a coffee and a donut down the street, came back here, time to watch some fights, really enjoying it. You know, second bout, or third bout in, maybe it was, I'm watching Lerone Murphy here, the miracle, up against Mr. Finland Makwan Amirakani, still in possession of one of the greatest Tapology profile photos of all time, if you want to go look that one up. And he lands just a one-hitter quitter knee, just right as Makwan is shooting in on him, and puts him to sleep with that one knee strike. And afterwards gets on the mic and is like, hey, doing the whole, hey Dana, 50 G's baby kind of thing. And I'm watching it at home and I'm going, yeah man, fuck yeah. And then I'm going, wait a minute, isn't this one of those fight cards with a ton of fucking fights on it? And aren't you just the third fight in? And maybe isn't there a good chance Dana White isn't even watching yet? And sure enough, the bonuses come down. This guy had really one of the only knockouts on the card. The only other knockout was Michael Oleksiak with Shamil Gamzatov. Nailed it. But this was the only one where it was just like that one shot, clean as hell knockout on the entire card. Still doesn't get one of the bonuses when they come through. We got performance of the night to Glover Teixeira and Khamzat Chimaev. You can understand both of those. Fight of the night to Peter Yan and Corey Sandhagen. That makes sense too. But man, sometimes doesn't it feel like these guys, you could do great fucking work on the prelims, and by the time we get to the main event, that people would have just completely forgotten what you did. Yeah. And chances are, if you're fighting on those prelims, you're one of the guys who will really notice that additional $50,000 in your life. I'm not saying that Glover Teixeira didn't even care about having an extra 50 G's added on there, but he just won the title. He's been in the UFC a long time, probably making pretty good money. Going to be making better money now with the belt around his waist. The 50 G's isn't make or break for him. For prelim fighters, we've seen sometimes it's the difference between, you know, breaking even on with the cost of your training camp and what you're getting paid and actually having a little bit of money going forward. Are you fucking kidding me? It just kind of highlights what a rough life it is, because this guy, he did exactly the stuff you'd expect to have to do if you're going out there trying to win a bonus at a UFC event, but because he does it on the prelims, third fight in, no dice, man. Fucking kidding me.
It's almost like the incentive-based post-fight bonus system is bullshit all the way around.
Yeah, almost.
Almost like there's better stuff you could do with that money if you wanted to. In any case, Ben, we talked last week about Mr. Fedor going out here and getting a big win over Tim Johnson. He is back in the news this week talking about Dana White on a Russian language television show here. He says, money means everything to him. This is Fedor talking about Dana White. He has no respect towards fighters, no respect for any human being, only money, and that's all. So Dana White obviously gets asked about this week, UFC 267 post-fight scrum. His quote is here. I'm reading this from Damon Martin's story over on MMA Fighting. He says, first of all, I don't even know Fedor. White says, Fedor doesn't know me. We met one time. So first of all, you fucking kidding me, dude?
We all kind of know you at this point, man.
Yeah, we all know you and we all know Fedor. Here's Dana again. His statement was, I was all about the money. He should have been more about the money when we made that offer, wherever the fuck we were, whatever island we were on, and you wouldn't still be fighting when you're 45 years old. Ben, the combined age of the two fighters in the main event of this UFC, UFC 267, the very night that Dana White is talking about this, was 80 years old. 42-year-old Glover Teixeira and 38-year-old Yanni Blackjacks just fought for the title. Are you fucking kidding me, dude? We just saw this. And you're going to like pick on Fedor for fighting at 45? Come on, man. You fucking kidding me?
Also, I thought the old line of reasoning Dana White used was that the reason Fedor didn't sign with the UFC then was because of greed, because his shady Russian managers wanted more than the UFC was offering. Now he's saying, like, your problem is you weren't greedy enough, or you would have taken our offer, and then you would have retired on that money. I mean, but the killer line for me is talking about, like, Fedor doesn't know me. And you're like, man, you've been an extremely public figure for 15 fucking years as the head of the UFC, making blogs about your life constantly, all this kind of, like, we have a pretty good sense at this point. A lot of people can do the you don't really know me kind of thing, but I think we all get a pretty good sense that there's not an extremely different version of Dana White in public and private from what we've seen.
Nobody
at this
thinks
point
that there's a hidden Dana White somewhere. It's like also, his private Dana White.
You know who he would probably admit does know him a little bit is Anderson Silva. And Anderson Silva said almost these same exact things after his exit from the UFC about Dana White, that he doesn't respect the fighters, that he only cares about money, and that he doesn't respect them as human beings. And it's like, well, Anderson seems like maybe he knows you a little bit. Maybe you got a chance to get to know you. He seems like he concurs with Fedor. What do you make of that?
Yeah, a guy who also took some UFC deals and is still out here fighting.
How about that?
In his mid-40s. You fucking kidding me?
Fucking kidding me?
All right, that's going to do it for round number one. We'll be right back with round number two.
Well, Chad, I got to about midway through round five in this interim bantamweight title fight between Peter Yan and Corey Sandhagen, and I believe I may have remarked out loud at the TV, man, Peter Yan's fucking good. He's just really fucking good, Chad.
Yeah.
Hey, Corey Sandhagen, especially early on, fought a pretty smart fight and was using a lot of his strengths the way we thought that he might against Peter Yan. But it's like, as the fight goes on and Peter Yan really finds his rhythm and settles into a fight, like, fourth round Peter Yan is some scary ass shit, man. Yeah. He starts chaining stuff together. He is out here just basically doing some kung fu movie shit to you, where he's just mixing in with his punching combos, spinning kicks and spinning back fists and landed them. Just landed them. And on a good fighter who had a pretty good game plan, it seemed, at least early on in the fight. I go after this fight and I'm thinking, he seemed like he was on his way to winning right before he lost in that Aljamain Sterling fight by just, you know, getting a little too creative outside the unified rules. He goes out here against a really good dude in Corey Sandhagen and looks awesome doing it. I'm sure he will come in as a pretty good favorite when he rematches Aljamain Sterling if that fight is able to happen. Like, in a really competitive division where we've seen people kind of struggle lately to put together prolonged success, Peter Yan seems like he really has what it takes to hold this shit down for a while.
Yeah, he's good just to start. And then he gets better as the fight goes, which is kind of scary. It's supposed to work the other way around. You're supposed to get tired. Peter Yan is out here seemingly with a cybernetic brain processing information and making adjustments mid-fight, and is better in the fourth and fifth rounds than he was at the start. And he's out there throwing spinning wheel kicks at the buzzer. Just as a flex, kind of. Just like, oh, I'm not tired here. Have a spinning kick as we wrap up 25 minutes of pretty fast pace men's bantamweight action. The 135-pound division is a goddamn shark tank right now. So it's not like I want to get ahead of myself talking about Peter Yan, but it does kind of... He is one of these guys where you look at him and you're like, who's going to beat this guy? Who on the list is going to be up for beating this guy? Because Corey Sandhagen also fought his damn guts out, fought a great fight, looked good throughout, didn't fade, threw a bazillion strikes, I think, was the official stat.
Yeah, and that's how the number came in, 1 bazillion.
Still didn't get it done. Still couldn't get it done. Still got edged. Still lost all but one round, I think, according to the official scorecards, to Peter Yan, who is... fast as shit, technically advanced, seemingly has a high fight IQ, makes adjustments in the fight, gets better as it goes, and is also just kind of mean.
Yeah.
Like, he has that mean streak that you need to be really good in this fight, in the fight game, where it's like, oh yeah, like I don't mind slipping in a hard ass elbow just on the break because it was there. Like, yeah, that's part of my shit. That's part of my skills right there. It's just like, doesn't seem to mind doing it, let's just say, which in this line of work is a positive.
Well, yeah, and you could just see that in some of these exchanges where Corey Sandhagen, he's trying to move, he's trying to just continually touch Peter Yan, and Yan is at some points maybe having a little bit more trouble finding him and getting him to stand still long enough, but like is quick enough and just can crack. There's a couple of these exchanges in this fight where you're seeing Corey Sandhagen be like, okay, I'm just going to reach out there and tag him a little bit, like not loading up on anything. Boom, boom, boom. Move, keep the feet moving. Boom, boom, boom. And then Peter Yan just comes back and is like, all right, well, here's two extremely hard punches in return that seem to have way more of an impact than anything you just did in the previous 15 to 20 seconds. And so it made me wonder, too, when Corey Sandhagen's getting off the stool to head into round five, you can hear his corner being like, we don't have to hit him hard. Like, let's just touch him. And it's like, man, that's kind of what you've been doing, and it's not working. And yet, what else would you advise him to do? Let's go power for power with Peter Yan? Because that doesn't seem like a great idea. You know, he's trying to use his range, trying to get that jumping knee that he likes to get people with, since they will sometimes just end up putting their head right in range for it. But you just can't really do anything to keep him from coming at you. And then when he does decide to let go, you could tell Corey Sandhagen is feeling those shots. I mean, he fought well and gutted through some tough moments there of his own. But damn, it just, there's not a whole lot of openings for you against this guy.
Yeah, it's a pretty compelling case right now for Peter Yan. You guess it seemed, you know, as you said in the potato index over on the comainevent.com this week, seems like you got to get to this guy early if you're going to get to him at all. And that in and of itself is easier said than done.
Yeah.
So it's going to be interesting to watch all of this, I think, develop at men's bantamweight, and one of the unknowns at this point we still don't have a real good sense of is what is going to happen with Aljamain Sterling's neck. He's coming off the surgery. It did look like Petr Yan was doing the Petr Yan thing in their fight, where he had had some trouble early, but was starting to stack up points kind of as that fight went on, and it seemed like maybe he was going to be cruising toward a decision win there. But I still would like to see it. I still want to see those two guys fight again, assuming that Aljamain Sterling is able to return and able to return at the top of his game. I still won't reject that fight. I think it's one that you got to have, obviously, to unify the title, and also just a good matchup of styles anyway. But you just look around the bantamweight rankings, and while it is one of the more competitive divisions in the UFC, it's also hard to put your finger on somebody where you're like, yes, this is the person who will come along and dethrone Petr Yan.
I mean, did the wind just whisper Henry Cejudo?
Yeah, where's he at?
You know where he's at. He's at home waiting for the phone to ring.
Yeah.
But, I mean, if you're Aljamain Sterling, you have to know that the clock is ticking right now, right? Because as much as the UFC would like to have you come back so we can say we're having the title unification fight, the rematch, there's bad blood after disqualification and the first one, they'd love to sell that and everything. But they also, it's not like the UFC has ever seemed like totally in love with Aljamain Sterling to begin with. Petr Yan is definitely an exciting fighter who people are pumped about. They just put this belt back on him in interim form, made a big deal about putting the stones, adding another stone to it, Chad. I don't know if you saw that. Yeah. The official jeweler of the UFC.
Official licensed jeweler of the UFC.
Gonna add another stone up in there. You have to know, if you're Aljamain Sterling, as a student of this game, that they're only going to give you so long to say, okay, I'm ready, let's book this rematch and get in there and do it, before they just decide, we're just going to go ahead and remove the interim from the name of Petr Yan's title. Like, it'll just disappear from the website one day. And it just be he'll just be the bantamweight champ, and you will just have a giant-ass paperweight. And yeah. And they will just act like, well, that's how it goes, we had to move on. Like, they're not going to give you a ton of time to get in there and settle this thing. So you got to kind of know that, and that puts some pressure on you, especially when the holdup is really stuff that to some extent is sort of out of your control.
Yeah, and it's a bummer for Aljamain Sterling, man, who is a good dude for all everything that we know about him, and like obviously a really talented fighter. Was not his fault the way that their first fight ended. It's not really his fault that he's now got this injury that is a bummer and a bastard to return from, that he just had to have this surgery. And you're right that it doesn't feel like anybody is really sweating bullets for him to return, right? And it's kind of a bad beat for Aljamain Sterling. So I hope he is able to come back. I hope that he is able to return at some high level and that we get to see this fight again, because I think it would be a good one in the 135-pound division. So it's one that I still hope that we get to see. I know that this pay-per-view or numbered UFC event was over in Abu Dhabi, so you're going to get a lot of Russian fighters. You're going to have a spotlight kind of on the Russian fighters here. You just run down the card, the main card of UFC 267. Magomed Ankalaev got a win. Khamzat Chimaev got a win. Alexander Volkov got a win. Islam Makhachev got a win. Petr Yan got a win. But are we on the verge of a Russian takeover here? Are the Russians going to take over? Are we fast forward a couple years and we're going to have four or five Russian champions in the UFC?
I mean, is there a real clear reason to think that it will be so different than what we saw when it seemed like there was a Brazilian takeover of the U.S.?
Right, like it happens in an evolutionary process. This happens in cycles. And are we on the verge of a Russian cycle here? Are the Russians about to take over this shit?
I mean, I've felt like at various points we've been on the verge of a Russian cycle, and I guess it just depends how many you feel like you need before you can call it a cycle. But I would also point out, I did a story years ago where a coach who I believe was from Dagestan, or he was from somewhere in the Caucasus region, and he was making the point that what people were calling a Russian takeover is a little bit more complex than that. And like that you see some fighters where it's like, okay, this guy's from Moscow or St. Petersburg or something like that, but that a lot of what we had previously regarded as a potential Russian takeover was Caucasus fighters. It was a little bit more like confined to that than it was just like the entirety of the land mass of Russia. That it was maybe more like Dagestani fighters, Chechen fighters, stuff like that. And I mean, as always with a sport like mixed martial arts, one of the things that always factors into it is where are they learning the skills that are going to come in handy in a sport that requires such diverse skills as mixed martial arts. That we've talked before where there would be every time there's a good British fighter, somebody's being like, oh, but he's going to have to do some catch up when it comes to wrestling because they're just not teaching wrestling well enough over there. But then that changes over time, right? Like people make those adjustments. But I think that a lot of what you're seeing now is you're seeing like a lot of fighters who come in there and they're like, well, like Khabib, I was wrestling a bear when I was a child, and that turned out to be a pretty good base for MMA, man.
Yeah.
Especially when, you know, it's like you're Khabib or you're Islam Makhachev or something where you're like, or Khamzat Chimaev, where you're like, I come in, I do this thing, everybody knows that I do it, but they can't fucking stop it. Like, that's a lot of ground to have to make up for everybody else.
Yeah. If you told me that we were going to fast forward 18 months and Peter Yan, Islam Makhachev, Khamzat Chimaev, and Magomed Ankalev were all champs, I wouldn't really be that surprised. Anyway, that's going to do it for round number two. We'll be right back with round number three. Ben, I don't know when the last time the UFC did numbered events on back-to-back weeks was, but here we go. UFC 267, the ink barely dry on the results, and we are headed back stateside to Madison Square Garden, New York City, to pull off UFC 268 on November 6th. Of course, the main event, as I said at the top of the show, a rematch between Kamaru Usman and Colby Covington, the co-main, a rematch for the women's strawweight title between Rose Namajunas and Zhang Weili. You also have a decent little main card here. Justin Gaethje about to fight Michael Chandler. Shane Burgos going to fight Billy Q. And Frankie Edgar going to fight Marlon Vera. That is all of your pay-per-view card. This is, you know, it's not every week we get to say this, man. It's not every week we get to go back-to-back with the UFC with two cards that seem pretty good and pretty vital. Of course, they gave us UFC 267 for free. We're going to have to probably shell out some bucks for UFC 268, but I ain't complaining. I will not complain that we have back-to-back fight cards in the hashtag just some fights era that actually feel like we're going to find some shit out, get some shit done, and see some good fights between a bunch of people that we recognize and have feelings about.
Yeah, just those top three fights alone make that a better pay-per-view than a lot of the stuff that the UFC has offered up in the last couple of years. I mean, the two title fight rematches, I could see how you make a case with both of them that, like, hey, maybe we didn't need this one right away. We didn't need this one right now. But they were both still, like, I mean, Rose Namajunas and Zhang Weili was an interesting matchup. I could see how you could say, like, okay, we wanted to see a little bit more of that just to be sure. And Colby Covington was the person who's been most competitive against Kamaru Usman in his championship reign, so fine, let's go ahead and do that again, and maybe if Kamaru Usman smashes him, we could be done with the Colby Covington gimmick for a while, which wouldn't be the worst thing. And also, I mean, Justin Gaethje versus Michael Chandler is a give-it-to-me-it's-mine kind of fight, no matter what it's for or where you put it. Like, yeah, that's just an action, fun-ass fight.
Yeah. Colby Covington, as you mentioned, still just in his early 30s, seems like he's been annoying us for years. He's fought just one time since his loss to Kamaru Usman, which was back at UFC 245 in December of 2019. He got the TKO injury win over Tyron Woodley in September of last year at a fight night event, just as Tyron Woodley was scooting out the door to go, get I Love Jake Paul tattooed on his finger. Kamaru Usman, by comparison, has fought three times, defended his title since then, wins over Jorge Masvidal, Gilbert Burns, and Jorge Masvidal in that order. Masvidal sandwich there around Gilbert Burns. I don't know that we have any reason to believe that the outcome here will be any different, and maybe even reason to suspect that this will be a more lopsided win for Kamaru Usman, but I guess we could be surprised. That's why they have the fights. And if I'm Colby Covington, I got to keep winning so they don't make me fight Khamzat Chimaev next. man, because I could see that. I could see that being one that they wanted to do. And yeah, got to get that gold. Got to keep the wolf from the door.
I don't know. Or maybe if you do get the gold, it just dooms you to fight Kamzat Chimaev.
Yeah, there's probably no way out of it for Colby Covington at this point. Do you expect anything different here from the first go-round with these two guys?
Just based on what we've seen lately, it, to the extent that I expect a different fight, I expect it to be more one-sided in favor of Kamaru Usman. He just looked like he is getting better and better, and that he is just more dangerous now than he was then. And Colby Covington, meanwhile, like, you don't see that he has that sort of one-shot power to put you away. It seems like he is still relying on weaponized pace, which works. He does it well, and he has been able to use that really well against some other people, but Kamaru Usman might be the worst possible matchup to try to do that against right now in the welterweight division. So I think Usman wins it, and I think it's probably a little less competitive than it was last time. You know what I was surprised to see, though, looking at this fight card, Chad?
What's that?
Your dude Edmund Shahbazyan is on this one.
We were just talking about him last week.
Doesn't it seem like before it was Edmund Shahbazyan is fight night main event kind of quality. The UFC is excited about it and wanted to put him in this position to be seen by a lot of people and have some success. And then he loses that, you know, he had that loss to Derek Brunson. He had lost to Gerald Meerschaert that came back there and exposed a little bit of the ground game.
It was singing and dancing Jack Hermanson.
That's who it was. It was singing and dancing Jack Hermanson. Sorry. But after that one, it seemed like, okay, now you're kind of stuck on the prelims and we're not even really mentioning your name leading up to the fight. You're just another guy who's there.
Oh, my guy, the news is worse. It's even worse than that for Edwin Shahbazyan, whose role, by the way, we had to slow considerably after those back-to-back losses. You went from being the next big thing, the new hotness in the UFC, to fighting on the prelims, Ben, against a 25-year-old Dagestani dude whose name is Nasruddin Imavov.
And who comes in as the betting favorite here.
Yeah, he's 9-3 overall, lost a majority decision to Phil Hawes back in February of this year. But then
who's also on this card, but yeah.
Ian Heinisch in his next appearance. Anytime they call you up and they say, hey, man, we know you're kind of a known entity. How do you feel about taking on an unknown 25-year-old Dagestani guy on the prelims?
I would
have some questions for my manager at that point.
They're kind of being like, we have another Edmund Shahbazyan in mind. We've decided to pivot, and you are no longer the Edmund Shahbazyan. He could potentially be our next Edmund Shahbazyan. We'd like you to fight him so we can find out, you know?
Yeah. We've taken the temperature in the room, and it seems like perhaps we're pivoting toward the Caucasus Mountains.
Not a great sign. Not a great sign. So this was supposed to be the one where Sean Strickland was going to fight Luke Rockhold, right?
Yeah, yeah. But then I think they had Sean Strickland had to be institutionalized, if I'm not mistaken. That's why they couldn't do that fight. He's in a straitjacket at this moment.
That is incorrect.
He
has broken out of Arkham Asylum, but... Luke Rockhold, in a classic old man move, bad back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Luke Rockhold heard about the breakout, the asylum breakout, and was like, oh, you know, when the weather gets cold in the fall, my back stiffens up. I'm not going to be able to make the date after all.
Well, it's a shame. I mean, that would have been a really nice addition to this fight card. And that we couldn't get a replacement opponent in there for Sean Strickland. I don't know, man. That could have really bumped it up to some really must-see TV. Although, again, just the three fights alone. Plus, I know you're excited about your guy, old man Edgar, going to roll up in here.
I mean, it's always a situation with Frankie Edgar now where you're a little worried when you see him on the fight card. I hope that we can all just come out of this one feeling good about ourselves. You know, Justin Gaethje against Michael Chandler is obviously a hell of a fight. Going to be excited for that one. And I don't want to totally give short shrift to Rose Namajunas versus Zhang Weili either, despite the fact that neither one of those women has fought anybody else since the last time they squared off. So it's going to be an immediate rematch of sorts and kind of a weird one when you consider how definitive the end result was in their first fight. But if I'm not mistaken, you could tell me if you disagree with that. If there's a title fight on this card that you feel like could easily go the other way. Yeah. Than they had on the first one, It's Nama Yunus versus Zhang Weili. No disrespect to Rose, who obviously is very talented and everybody likes her pretty well around these parts. But like, you know, you just don't know if she could beat Zhang Weili again, or Zhang Weili could come in, have a better showing and take that title back. I think it's into my mind, kind of a push at this point, or sorry, kind of a pick 'em.
Kind of a tough one after you get less than a minute and a half of action in that one. But then if she does, if Zhang Weili comes here, gets the title back, are we doing it again, brother?
I mean, you'd have to, wouldn't you?
I don't know. I mean, that's when you risk the audience getting a little fed up with it. If you're like, okay, here we go. Especially because it's like when you look at Rose's record, where it's like Joanna Jędrzejczyk, then Joanna Jędrzejczyk, then Jessica Andrade, then Jessica Andrade, then Zhang Weili, and now again Zhang Weili. You're going like, oh, Jesus Christ. Like, can we just get something else? You know, like, I think you run the risk of just getting people to think that every time they show up to see a fight in this division, it's, you know, basically a rerun of what we've already seen.
Yeah, but at the same time, if you're Rose and you won the fight via head kick the first time and they turn around and made you fight Zhang Weili again immediately, if you lose this one, aren't you a little bit like, okay, well, is turnabout not fair play here? Do I get the same?
Oh, yeah, fair play, that's what would guide the UFC's decisions.
Hey, man, you don't know Dana White. You don't know this man.
Got a pretty good sense by now, I think, honestly.
You know, when you're Dana White, it really is kind of it's a signal of the kind of life you lead that you can't remember what island resort you were on when you talked to Fedor. I don't know. We were on one of these islands that I frequent. I can't remember which one it was. Just on some island.
One of these secret islands that we all traveled to in order to make a business deal.
All right, let's do just saying stuff, Ben, and then we're going to get out of here for this week. Did you see this back and forth on the Twitter machine between Daniel Cormier and Justin Gaethje?
Yeah. Yeah.
So Cormier goes out there. He says, give Islam Makhachev the title fight. I don't even need to see who wins next week. This dude just killed it. Habib said this was his MSG moment, and boy, he did he not deliver. He's going to be the champ. Gaethje responds, suck it harder, DC, which is cuts straight to the point of that one, right?
And succinct, then, you know?
They kind of go back and forth here. Daniel Cormier says, I can't fight you, but Islam can be my guy. You just go and do what you do next week. You may be safe. I'm not sure, champ. Gaethje says, you brought my name up, et cetera, et cetera. Cormier comes back with some stuff here. And I mean, I love Daniel Cormier. I love his work on the mic. He was one of my favorite fighters during his UFC tenure. I thought he was a great two-division champ there. I'm just saying, though, it's a little weird when you're on the broadcast team. We know that Habib is your guy. We know that you're teammates with Habib. It's a little weird when the cameras catch you hugging Islam Makhachev in the cage right before you're supposed to interview him as a, you know, reportedly as a broadcaster, if not a journalist, but, you know, about to interview this guy and then, you know, camera catches you hugging him. We know that you're best bros with Habib. And then you jump on your socials and you're like, give this guy the title shot. I don't know. I'm just saying, it's a weird look, man. It's a little bit of a weird look. I'm not saying people can't have opinions. I'm not even really criticizing Daniel Cormier because I do like his work. I think he's good at it. But it's a little weird to do that. I'm just saying.
Just saying. It must feel for Daniel Cormier, it feels like after like every Monday, whatever he was he's been saying in and around the UFC event over the weekend has somebody mad at him.
Yeah.
His life as a commentator on the sport is not all roses, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Welcome to the media game, Daniel Cormier. But it's like, it's one of the risks you run when you have so many either current or freshly retired fighters work in your broadcast booths, is you're going to have these various kind of conflicts of interest where, your buddy's fighter is going out there and winning a fight. And it puts you in a weird spot, man. Puts you in a weird spot.
It does. Well, Chad, my just saying stuff this week, I'm just saying you guys are getting a little weird with this Hezbollah stuff.
Yeah, it's pretty, it's one of those things that, again, it just makes you question, are you watching a real sport? Are you watching a real sport or are you watching some sideshow stuff right now?
I mean, I get, especially because I keep seeing him referred to as a social media star, but it also seems like, you know, the Dagestani fighters and everything, that they seem to to love having him around, but it also seems like they're kind of treating him like a mascot a little bit.
Yeah, like, it's weird. It's not like a guy who's been dealt a tough hand by life, so we're here to support him and, like, you know,
right,
make his dreams come true and all this stuff. It's more like, you know, it's cringier than that.
Especially because at several points when they're sort of like celebrating with him and they're like grabbing him and picking him up or petting him on the head. And especially because it's just like when we're showing him in his beef with whoever the dude is where he's beefing. And it seems like the joke that some people can't get enough of is he's angry and willing to be as violent as any of the rest of us, except very small. Isn't that hilarious? Mm-hmm. And I'm just going, man, you guys are really not tired of this bit yet, huh? He is really just doubling down. And let me tell you something, Chad. God forbid you say something on social media like, this is getting weird, you guys. Because there's a whole lot of people who seem to think that this whole bit is the most hilarious fucking thing they've ever seen. And that is a hill they will die on. They will not even hear the whole thing being criticized by anyone. I'm just saying, you guys are getting a little weird with it, man.
Mm-hmm.
You're getting a little bit weird.
It's been weird for a while now.
Just saying.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's going to do it for this week's Co-Main Event podcast. Thanks for joining us. Remember, we're going to be over on the Patreon page all week doing our stuff, doing all of our fun stuff that everyone loves, and you should join in and listen along to it and give us the pittance of money that we want for it. You should do that. That's something you should do. I'm assuming you're asleep right now, and I'm speaking directly to your subconscious mind, but you should log on the Patreon and give us the money that we ask for.
Dollar a month, what's that? It's not even money.
Patreon.com/co-main event. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back next week with the proper breakdown, all the stuff that happens at UFC 268. As for right now, though, we're done. We are through. We are out.
See this? I think we should move full time into the sleep. We market those like we'll help you get back to sleep kind of audio things, right?
Yeah.
But then, once you are asleep, you just whisper subconscious messages to give us your money.
Yeah, speaking of things getting a little weird, that's what we're doing. We're full on. Subliminal hypnosis messaging.
I'm not sure how to do subliminal messaging, but I think if you whisper, that's it, right? Like, as soon as you start whispering, yeah. That's all it takes.
It's like sometimes when you